Ralph Waxman. It's a pleasure to be back here again to be speaking to you gentlemen. The topic for tonight is the challenge of modernity, a Hirschian response. I say Hirschian rather than just pure Ralph Hirsch, although it's mostly based on what Ralph Hirsch wrote and thought. I'll be bringing in other people and other sources, so it's not strictly in terms of what Ralph Hirsch said. In trying to keep with good Dale Carnegie technique, my wife Sharon, and a lot of you know, told me, do not give any quotations whatsoever. And as what Ralph Waxman can tell you, I always listen to my wife. Sometimes not quite 100%. Okay, but I will. There'll be very few quotations. Anyone that's interested in terms of hearing what the sources are, wants to know where the sources are, feel free. If you want to just take my explanation and the world according to Slater, that's fine too. Okay, but we can discuss that afterwards, anyone who's interested. When we use the term modernity and modern, okay, we generally look at it as something positive, a compliment, right? I mean, there's very few examples that we can think of in which the connotation is pejorative. Okay, when we use the terms antediluvian, antiquated, medieval, that's usually an insult. Okay, it's a disparaging remark. But with modern, we're generally talking about something that is viewed in a positive light. There are very few, maybe, exceptions to that. I was trying to think of them. Perhaps some people with modern art. Okay, but really, the only example that I could really think of where there's a true ambivalence, and that's modern Orthodox. Right? In fact, that, in our time, in the last 20 years, that has had such pejorative connotations that the modern Orthodox now want to be called centrist Orthodox. Okay? Basically, have the same thing, but instead of using the term modern, we're going to say centrist. Okay, that I think really illustrates, okay, the tension between the Torah view, Torah world, and our modern world. What is modernity? What am I going to be speaking about when I say the term modern? Okay, is it being up to date in technology, in fashion, in culture? You go to the latest movies, you wear the latest fashion. Well, it can be that. Okay, but that's not the area that I'm interested in. Okay, what I really want to talk about is the intellectual revolution that's taken place in the last 350 years. Okay, this is an unprecedented way in which people think and view the world. Okay, Professor Alan Charles Coors, an intellectual historian at the University of Pennsylvania, he said that if a culture changes the way that it thinks about using mind properly, it changes the way it thinks about almost everything. Okay, and I want to speak about the changes and differences in terms that we view the world and in which our forebears and at least the European world a few hundred years ago viewed the world. Okay, and there are great changes. I don't want to discuss practical matters either. Okay, let me point that out now. In terms of various practical matters, in terms of obscene or inappropriate material that you can find on the internet, that can be bombarded to you on the TV, the radio, the newspapers and magazines, how to keep kosher when you're touring in Tibet, can you attend professional conferences on Shabbat, things like this. This is not of interest. Okay, what I really want to be discussing is in terms of how modernity has influenced our outlook on the world and in terms of how we view the world. Let me start out with some simple illustrations. When we step outside and look up at the sky, okay, we feel dwarfed. Okay, we really think, I mean, we don't even like to think about what we're looking at. Okay, because we're talking about distances and sizes of objects that appear tiny, they're immense. Okay, it's incomprehensible. I mean, the distances and the size of these things and the amount of time that it takes to travel to them, we feel dwarfed. In that sense, also, modern man, this is certainly not the Torah perspective, but modern man feels dwarfed and he has a conception of God that's been dwarfed. Okay, the universe that we now comprehend, that we see, okay, for many, dwarfs even God. Voltaire said, okay, about 250 years ago, that man is so small in this puny universe, okay, that it's actually funny that God would have any interest in him. Okay, which basically Voltaire is implying that size would really matter to God. Okay, that somehow God can't manage it. It's interesting also, a lot of contemporary biologists will give you the argument, you know, how could God have had a hand in anything? I mean, if we have 25 different tortoise shells or turtle shells in the Galapagos Islands, you really think that God would have the time and the interest to design each one of them? Okay, this is a very interesting thing in terms of their conception of God and our conception of God. However, let's go back 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. Rashi stepped outside and looked up at the sky. Okay, he's seeing a very different thing from what you're saying. He's got a cozy little universe. Okay, classical medieval world, they're looking at something that you fly higher in a... When you flew here to Israel, you were flying much higher than they ever imagined that the sky could be. Okay, they saw seven spheres. Okay, the stars traveled in one sphere, the planets in another. That's how they explained the whole world. And to them, it was perfect. It was symmetrical. It was a symbol of the divine. Okay, it was a cozy little world. Also, another thing to remember, in terms for the West, in Europe. What was Europe at the time? Okay. For Rashi, what was the challenge? There had been no Shakespeare or Schiller or Tolstoy. Okay, there was no Haydn, Mozart, or Beethoven. There was no Rembrandt, Monet, no Newton, Pasteur, Einstein. Okay, all this didn't exist. Europe was a primitive backwater. Okay, it posed no intellectual challenge to the Torah world. 99% of the people couldn't even read or write. The 1% who could, basically the priests, the monks, okay, they were mostly reading our stuff, poor translations, misinterpretations, and the chutzpah to tell us, you know, how we should interpret it. Okay, there's very little literature, very little art. Europe, as we know it now in terms of what it produced, did not exist. In fact, interesting thing, I learned this recently, about 500 years ago, what was the richest, most powerful country in the world? We're not even talking Rashi's time, we're talking 1500. The richest, most powerful country in the world, most developed, was China. The second richest, most powerful developed country in the world, or area, because India was divided up into regions, was India. Okay, the third was the Arab world. Okay, Europe was poor, backward, and primitive. Okay, so at least for Ashkenazi Jewry, Western Jewry, or European Jewry, there is not much of a challenge here. So it was a nice, cozy little world, not posing intellectual threat. Okay, but it was a world in which death also was everywhere. And I'm not talking just about pogroms. Okay, people up until about 150 years ago used to die at all ages. Okay, mostly due to infectious disease. Okay, but plagues were rampant. Okay, you go to graveyards even well into the 19th century, and you see the gravestones, people died at all, from infancy to old age. Okay, so death was something that was a reality for people. How does that affect you? Well, think about it. For us, I'm the oldest guy in this room, I think, yeah, definitely. I'm the oldest guy in this room. Do I really, even at my advanced age, do I really see death as something imminent? Not yet. So on Yom Kippur, excuse me, on Rosh Hashanah, okay, in Musaf, you're saying Unasana Tokef. Okay, intellectually I understand, yeah. God, next minute, next second, I'm not here. Okay, that's an intellectual thing. It's not part of our everyday reality. Okay, back then you could have smallpox, plagues like this. People got it, wildly contagious, 30-40% dead. Okay, so in Rashi's time, well actually we didn't have Unasana Tokef in Rashi's time. Okay, let's go back 600 years ago, 700 years ago. Okay, then you're saying there, Omi Yicher, Omi Yamut, and you're looking around the shul, And you see that you're thinking, how many people aren't there? Who were there a year ago? Not only that, a lot of them were younger and healthier than you are. Okay, so just our everyday life is very different. You can say, why then, why bother in terms of confronting the challenges of modernity? Right, I'll just stay in my own Dalit Amas, and I don't have to deal with it, I'll avoid it. Well, you can do that with some things. In terms of practical matters that I was talking about, what you're going to be bombarded with from the media, okay, how to do a business lunch appropriately, things like that, yeah, you can avoid that. Okay. However, the intellectual challenge, and I don't care where you're living, okay, you could be in Lakewood, Woodmere, Golders Green, Benet Rock, No Fire Lawn. Okay, the intellectual ideas and the intellectual challenge, okay, still comes through. About a year ago, after an early Shabbat, okay, Howie Schiffmiller, maybe some of you guys know him, probably you know the Schiffmillers. Howie comes up to me with a mischievous smile after davening. He says to me, you got to listen to this. Okay, you're going to love it. He told me he got an email from his brother in New York. And his brother sent him this, some guy posting something that he was saying that Chazal said that the sun orbits the earth. Anyone who says differently is a kofir. Okay, and he said, this wasn't for Purim. Okay, now, if you look at this, that, wow, this guy, this Emunat Chachamim, it's one way to look at it. They ask him, why are you ignoring other Gemaras that Rambam brings down, Rav Hirsch certainly brings down other people, in terms of where Chazal say that the non-Jews have a more accurate, what seems to be more accurate scientific explanation, we accept it. Okay? But this man is not shielding himself from modernity. And that reaction is so strong, okay, that he's simply taking a... Yeah, but he's reacting to it. He's not avoiding it. Okay? Another incident, about 5 years ago, Sharon and I were having dinner in Manhattan with my aunt, uncle, and cousin, who were not observant. And I forget how it came up. My cousin was saying that the Christian fundamentalists, in terms of attacking the teaching of evolution in the schools, and how terrible it is. And I said, well, you know, they have some points. Okay, I'm not quite so sure, convinced that evolution did take place. Okay, this is something that is more likely to come to us. And she was shocked. Okay, she said, what, someone like you really thinks that? No, she didn't say that. She's too polite. Okay, probably some of you were thinking that also here. Okay, you know who you are. Okay, but I understand that too, because I thought that way. Okay, but these, we have to deal with these issues. There's no hiding from those issues. Okay, now we're going to get back to the evolution, because in terms of Rob Hirsch's approach to it, okay, but these issues cannot be ducked. How do people accept knowledge? What do they regard as being acceptable for knowledge, let's say 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago? The classical world, the medieval world. Okay, it was mostly accepted in terms of inherited intellectual authority. Okay, and for in the early part of the Middle Ages, that authority was usually Plato, okay, but by the middle to late Middle Ages, that authority was Aristotle. Okay, if Aristotle said it, okay, then this was accepted. They definitely accepted the idea of you can refer to experience and reason, okay, but these were secondary to inherited intellectual authority. The way that knowledge was arrived at and synthesized, the way that you proved that something was true, was called the disputatio, in which mostly you'd be taking something from Aristotle, okay, maybe something else, and in a syllogism you would synthesize it and show that if Aristotle said this and Aristotle said that, maybe we can know this. Okay, you may use an appeal to experience or to reason, okay, but that did not overrule the authority of Aristotle. Okay, I remember when I was about 10, I was reading, I was becoming interested in astronomy, so I read a biography of Galileo. Okay, one of these, I think, scholastic books, biographies. Okay, I remember to this day there was a section in the book in which Galileo was taking on the Aristotelian professors. Okay, in the the University of Padua. All right, and the idea with Aristotle was that the heavier an object is, the faster it falls. Okay, we now don't believe that, right? In gravity, things fall at the same rate. What is it, 32, you guys probably took the physics, 32 feet per second, that's the acceleration, something like that, of gravity. Okay, and it doesn't matter for the object. If objects fall differently, it's due to other factors, okay, such as air resistance, etc. Okay, so I remember that this demonstration in this book, Galileo took a sheet of paper like this to the professors, and he drops it. Falls around. They go, yeah, of course, you know, paper's light, so it falls much slower than a stone. He goes, yeah? And he takes the paper and crumples it and drops it. Drops much faster now. How do you explain that? Okay? I remember thinking at the time, oh my God, if I lived back then, okay, I could have won multiple Nobel Prizes. Those people were so stupid. They were so stupid. Okay, and I'm sure it wasn't just me. I'm sure this is the way the book was designed to tell the story. Okay, but those people weren't stupid. They had a very different way of looking at the world. Okay? How do I know that? The Rambam. Rambam was a big Aristotelian. Rambam believed that. If you would have asked the Rambam, has an object fall to the ground, he would have told you, yeah. The heavier it is, the faster it falls. Aristotle said so. You're going to call the Rambam an idiot? That's for sure, right? So we tend to have a very smug view, which is also one of the, we're going to get into that also, that's also one of the ideas of modernity that causes the problem. Anyhow, it's easy to see when you have established intellectual authority, that's how you know something. Okay, in fact, also that these people, they believe that the ancients were much greater than the moderns. Okay, all these ideas in terms of this kind of world, this fits in very well, okay, with religious perspective in general, a Torah perspective in particular. Okay, that's a comfortable world. Okay, but times have changed. There's been an overthrow of that old world order. It started, it was a gradual event. Say that some of the start of it began in the Renaissance. Okay, which is the Renaissance wasn't that revolutionary. They still looked at the ancients as being better. Okay, but instead of now having one source of authority, the church, Europe now had two. Okay, the classical secular world. Okay, but the real changes began in terms of the 1500s with the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation. Okay, what that did, okay, when Luther broke away from the Catholic Church and formed Protestantism, that showed that religious authority can be challenged. Okay, that was the first dent. Then about 1600, an Englishman, Francis Bacon, okay, decided, this whole idea of appealing to Aristotle hasn't gotten us too far, okay, which was true, okay. Medicine, knowledge of biology, this is all basically what Aristotle said, that was it. He said, we have had basically no technological improvements. What we have to do, and he wrote this in his Novum Organum, okay, we need a new method, and that's what Novum Organum means, new method. And he said, we can't rely in terms of what Aristotle said. We have to go out there to nature and study nature and test nature and experiment. Okay, so that's part one. All of a sudden now, we're getting a move, what makes knowledge, experience, and then reason based on that experience. And that's what led to the scientific revolution, okay, in the late 17th century. Isaac Newton, Kepler, okay, and finally, with the Enlightenment. In the Enlightenment, okay, post-Voltaire and the philosophes, okay, is the idea that the moderns are superior to the ancients or to our ancestors in all matters. Okay, so we've now had the birth of the modern mind, okay, in 5 minutes, doesn't do it justice, but okay, that's basically the idea. And there are four characteristics of the modern mind that really weren't there in the classical world, that pose a very stiff challenge, okay, certainly to a Torah perspective. Okay, number one is the attitude that reason is supreme. Okay, this is not new to the world. Okay, right, we're going to read Parshat Korach. We have Medrash on that. Okay, and what is Korach argue with the Moshe Rabbeinu? Okay, right? If you have a room full of Sifrei Torah, kid, you need to put a mezuzah on the door. Okay, Moshe Rabbeinu says yes. And Korach laughs. That's ridiculous, right? That's ridiculous. That's that common sense. Human reason cannot say. What does Moshe Rabbeinu say? It's not really a lot for him to say. It's God says so. Okay, but that's not an appeal necessarily to reason. So anyhow, in terms of what we have today, though, we have this even to a greater extent, okay, than ever existed before, okay, because we know better in all things. Great illustration of this, okay, we have now most of the Western societies, okay, we have a push to have same-sex marriage, okay. Now, this is a concept that has never come before in human history. One attitude may say, okay, well, it may seem like a good idea, but maybe we should go slow here, because no one else has ever thought that this is an appropriate idea or a good idea. Okay, but we know better. Okay, we now know that this makes sense, this is a real moral option, and everyone else who came before us, they had it wrong. And basically, the tension here, in terms of the supremacy of human reason, which is posed by the modern world, with us, is that for us, it really doesn't matter. The Torah true Jew, okay, will never permit something that the Torah forbids, or will act against the Torah, no matter how good the reason or the logic is. Okay? And that's a tension. Okay, secondly, we have the idea that all knowledge and reality must be based upon empirical experience. Okay, we have the expression, seeing is believing. Okay? And that's basically, in terms of, we regard knowledge as being mostly scientifically based. Okay, and that means it's based on observable phenomena, physical phenomena, things that we can perceive with our senses. Okay. I don't have to tell you in terms of what that means, in terms of miracles then become fictitious hallucinations of a primitive mind. Okay, that especially becomes true if no one alive that you know has actually witnessed a miracle. It also makes belief in an invisible God and an immortal soul that much more difficult. If these things are regarded, if it's not something that's empirical, it does not exist. It is not real. Thirdly, there's been the rejection, as we said before, of inherited intellectual authority. Okay, how does this go to an extreme? Well, I'm not going to read you something now because this is just so mind-boggling. About 5 years ago, in the San Diego area, a man named McCusker died, who was born a Catholic. Can we save questions for the end? There was a gentleman, McCusker, who was born Catholic. Apparently, he was a well-known homosexual, and the bishop of the San Diego diocese forbid him to be buried as a Catholic. Okay, so behind this, the bishop buried plenty of other openly gay men. Okay, that wasn't his problem. His problem with McCusker was that McCusker earned his living by operating a bar to promote homosexual relations. Okay, he felt that a person who's a homosexual, who's a Catholic, he may have sinned as a Catholic, he's entitled to a Catholic burial. He's a Catholic who sinned. There are Catholics who sin, but he's entitled to a Catholic burial. Okay, when you start deciding that you're going to earn your livelihood by promoting something that goes against the teachings of the church, as he said, is too much. Okay, so he ordered all almost 200 churches not to give him a Catholic burial. Okay, this is responded to in the San Diego, an editorial in the San Diego Union Tribune in March of 2005. And I'll read you a section of this. In our view, the real scandal is Bishop Baum's narrow-minded ostracism of McCusker. To our knowledge, McCusker never has been accused of doing anything illegal. If Bishop Baum has information to the contrary, he should step forward with it. Okay, all of a sudden, the issue is now, is this man violated secular law? Okay, we respect the Catholic Church's denunciation of homosexual acts on moral grounds, just as we respect the Church's denunciation of abortion on moral grounds. At the same time, we respect the many morally upright individuals who do not share the church's views on homosexuality and abortion. What should bind people on both sides of these divisive issues is a shared respect for the dignity of every human being. Okay. What the newspaper is saying is that a Catholic bishop does not have the right to say who gets a Catholic burial. What civil rights are violated here? Okay, this is the idea. Doesn't matter. If McCusker feels he's a good Catholic, he wants a Catholic burial, McCusker is entitled to a Catholic burial. Who cares what the bishop thinks? Okay, this is where we are in terms of our times and state of rejection of intellectual authority or inherited authority. Okay, also add this. I remember 25 years, maybe 30 years ago, Jewish Theological Seminary, before the Yamin Mirayim, ran an ad in the Sunday New York Times, full page. Okay, and it went something like this, why we were on a higher spiritual level than Rabbi Akiva. Okay, that's the idea behind it. We know better. Okay, the past has no authority over us. Finally, we have this idea just now in terms of progress. Okay, we believe that progress is ineluctable, that we are far superior than previous generations in every sphere. Technology, okay, certainly a good argument can be made for that, but also culturally, morally. Okay, there's a smugness in that. Okay, cultural superiority, you know, we're really going to argue that Michael Jackson was in advance on Beethoven. Okay, moral superiority in terms of what has happened over the last 100 years, World War I, Armenian massacres, rape of Nanking, Shoah, okay, just what we've had in our own time, the Rwanda genocide, the genocide now in Darfur. I mean, you could go on. I can't even remember all of them because it's such a long list. Okay? We're superior. Think about this. Okay? I think now in New York City, the number of murders committed every year, and New York City has a population right between 7 to 7.5 million. There are about 400 murders committed every year in New York City. In the state of Israel, which has about the same population, about 160 murders committed. Right? You think you factor out all the murders with non-Jews, may even have a lower rate than that. Makes you proud, right? Think about this. In the 1880s, in London, which also had about 7 to 7.5 million people, the average murder rate per year in London for the 1880s was 20 to 30 people. Progress. Okay. Let's not say we haven't made any progress. Things say you have to look at the whole picture. We're smug. Okay. I mean, you talk to any politician, cop, or anyone, you're going to get the murder rate in New York City down to 20 to 30 a year. They'll laugh at you. It's not possible. Right? Crowded conditions like that. Okay. What happened in terms of the effect of modernity on European Jewry, okay, was devastating. Absolutely devastating. The reaction was that modern science, modern culture has now shown religion to be false. Okay, coupled with that, in terms of your entry ticket, in terms of increasing your standard of living, would also be enhanced by rejecting a Torah way of life. Reaction of most of the religious establishment, okay, was by and large knee-jerk. Okay, ignore it, shut up. It's horrible. It was on part of some people. There were attempts at rational defense or rational attacks in terms of the of modernity, but by and large, it was a knee-jerk reaction against it. Okay, and Jews. Certainly the more in Western Europe, which was more exposed to the ideas of modernity. Okay, we're leaving in droves. It's hard to imagine. Okay, but almost no one who grew up in an observant home, let's say in Germany in the first half of the 19th century, the 1800s, remained religious. Okay? You had religious parents. None of the children were religious. This is when terms of reform were starting. And one of the leaders of reform, Samuel Holdheim, okay, put the question. He challenged the Jews of his generation. He said to them, a Jew has only one choice, either to remain in the Dalit Amos of a rabbinic Judaism, stuck in the past, or to live in the modern world and cease to be Orthodox. Okay, and the answer for the vast majority, the overwhelming majority, I'm talking 95% of the Jews living in Western Europe, was to cease to be totally observant. Okay, enter Rav Hirsch. Okay, and this is not going to be a standard lecture in terms of Rav Hirsch. I already said I'm going to bring in more Hirschian ideas rather than strictly what he said. But Rav Hirsch took the approach that modernity has to be confronted. Okay, what he did was to use the methodology of modernity in terms of to limit its excesses and to show where it had overreached, and more importantly, to show that those very principles in terms of the working of the modern mind can be applied to show that Torah is emet. Let me just clarify now that in terms of, we don't have knockout punches here. Because what was, there are no knockout punches. The biggest knockout punch, okay, will be to show that the other side doesn't have knockout punches. Okay, your ideas going around, for instance, that the argument for design, which is still very popular, Rav Hirsch used it himself, Hume attacked this to show that it's only at best probable. Okay, but probable, okay, is something. We're going to go see then how Rav Hirsch reworked that in terms of his approach to evolution, in terms of reworking the argument from design. Okay, so what he did was, number one, he rejected the idea. There were some people who, in the late 18th century, early 19th century, and into the 19th century, they were willing to, and I think to this day, actually, they were willing to accept religion, the idea of religion, as something beyond knowledge. Okay, it was belief, spirituality. Okay, spirituality came in at this time. Okay, people's idea in terms of the approach to religion, okay, if you're going to be religious, you're embracing the irrational. Okay, I actually should have said already, I think it's no mistake that a lot of movements, actually irrational, counter-rational, began at this time. Among the Christians, you had the Fideist movement, okay, which was led by Blaise Pascal and Pierre Bayle. Okay, and I don't know if either those two said it, but their motto was, I believe because it's impossible. Okay, and we're talking about very intelligent people here. Pascal, that name for you guys should probably ring a bell, either from your math or science classes. Yeah, it's the same Pascal. Okay, this guy was a brilliant scientist. Okay, but he adopted the idea that to be religious is to embrace something that's totally irrational. Okay, the idea of spirituality is starting now. Okay, I think it's no coincidence that Hasidus also starts during the same period. Okay, we're talking about from 1650 forward. Okay, seances, okay, begin to become popular in Europe. Okay, these things didn't exist before. You have all kinds of interesting things. And number one, Rav Hirsch completely rejects this. Okay, he said that the spirit of Israel does not produce ecstatics who lose their grip on reality and go mad. Judaism yearns for God's closeness, but requires of man clarity of thought, a composed and sober mind. Okay, so his approach was the basis for our belief, and it's not belief, it is knowledge. Okay, and he proceeds to explain why. Okay, he used basically an attack on in terms of biblical criticism. Okay, using the method of science to show that they're overreaching in terms of the claims that they are making, okay, that the Torah is made up, that it's not based on fact, it's a jump, it's a speculation. Most importantly, what he wants to do is that the Torah itself, meaning also revelation, must be established as something that is knowledge. Okay, and he wants to include, and he writes this in the 19 letters, that the Torah is to be included terms of when you look at a problem, you have the physical world, and the Torah is a fact just like that. How does he do this? Well, in his writings, particularly in his Perush on the Torah, also in his essays, he does this by slow accumulation of points. That's the best way to put it. For instance, he wants to show that the law that we get in the Torah, okay, this is a great, that's God's law. There's a disparity between God's law and man's law. What does he point out? Because throughout human history, the law of the time, man's law, reflects the state of that society at that time. Okay, that's why secular law of the state is continually changing. Okay, it says, what we get in the Torah is God's law. And God's law, the people, the Jewish people, have never been lived up to that, okay, what God's law demands. Okay, an example of that. So, Shemitah. Look at Shemitah. He had tremendous problems observing that. Not only that, he said, you take something like Shemitah, is this something that was made up by man? He says, what political leader would be so insane to try and bring to his people that, hey, 1 year we're not going to do any planting whatsoever? Crop rotation we can understand, right? Okay, in fact, there's a misconception among many people that actually what's in the Torah is crop rotation. No, it's not crop rotation. We're not going to plant. Okay, what political leader would be so insane to suggest such a thing? Okay, no one. Okay, political leaders here and now on this, men do not suggest such a thing. Okay, this is an example in terms of, this is can only be from God. And not only that, it's so difficult for people, we didn't even observe it. Right? Most of the Shemitot were never observed. That's how difficult it was. God's law, okay, is not like man's law. He looks in terms of the predictions, in terms of the punishment, in terms of not observing Torah. This is, again, another one of his attacks in terms of on the Bible critics, where he points out, the Bible critics right to point out, you know, all these warnings, if you don't observe Torah, this is written after the fact, you know, after the, it's written up after the first Churban. His reply is, we're not even going to look at that. So why is it true to this very day? Now we can pass Rav Hirsch's time, it's true. Okay? What's saying there? That was written after the fact? It's like, the idea even to the Bible critics, to the Wissenschaft Judentums, which is the Jewish Bible critics, you want to make that argument even? We don't have to even argue in terms of that Torah goes back over 2,000 years. Okay, you want to make that claim that these predictions were written after the first Churban? How do you explain that it's been true to this day? Another point. Again, he says the Jewish people are unique. Okay, both in their formation. Okay, what other people in human history has become a nation, okay, not living on their own land? Okay, that's unique in terms of the history of the world. In fact, looking at the ancient world, when you lost your land, you were finished as a people. That's why all these, you could look in terms of the ancient world, all these other peoples that were around, they're gone. Okay, because as soon as you were conquered, okay, your conqueror made sure that you would cease to exist. And he shows, again, that our ancestors were not a bunch of primitives. We can show it from the Tanakh itself. In Parshat Noach, I think it's from Yeshayahu, where Yeshayahu is saying that Hashem is comforting the Jewish people, don't worry, I'm not going to forsake you. And so what does he say? He says, V'yeshit nu'arim ki tamais amar elokayach. Okay, and actually I think this wasn't Rav Hirsch, his son Mendel Hirsch is actually one to make this point. Okay, that what kind of reassurance is that? Right? I mean, he's saying the bride of your youth never becomes repulsive. Because this point, Mendel Hirsch points out, in our society, who could get up and make such a claim? Don't worry about it. It's good. Just like, you know, bride never becomes repulsive to her husband, I'm going to stand by you. Okay, we have 50% divorce rate, right? You can't even say that the Jewish community is different. Okay, again, this is not only that, but it also tied it. What kind of progress have you made? Okay, but it's in the Tanakh. I mean, what kind of state? No minister could get up. No politician. No one could get up. You'd be laughed at. You'd be laughed at, right? Wife never becomes repulsive to her husband. Okay, so it's an accumulation of things like this that he brings down to show that, yeah, it's different, and it's something like this. When you show the divine origin of the Torah, basically the argument then becomes is that the Torah and Revelation become empirical facts, okay, just as the physical world does, and so and also that that invisible God really does exist. To take a concrete illustration of Rav Hirsch's approach. Okay, quickly, in terms of what's his approach to evolution? Okay, he says that according to what we accept as a basis of knowledge, based on empirical facts, how the world was created is something that's not knowable. It is not knowable. Okay, it cannot be witnessed. Okay, it cannot be demonstrated. Okay, scientific knowledge must be both retrodictive and predictive. Okay, and maybe evolution can give you a prediction, can explain how we got to be where we are, okay, but it cannot predict, it has no predictive value in terms of where we are going. Okay, so it's at best retrodictive, and even that's debatable because it cannot be necessarily demonstrated. There are no witnesses, and the whole theory works by inference. And he goes on to say, and if it's true, so what? Because he admits all of it. I mean, we don't know ourselves in terms of really how the world was created. Okay? So that's important. We don't know if it's true or not true. If evolution were to be true, so what? Okay, Chazal is very divided in terms of how the world was created, the age of the world, etc. Okay? Then he starts pointing out the serious flaws in this theory. Some of these, I guess, are well known, gaps of the in the fossil record. Okay, but most important, and this is the argument I think it's made by advocates of intelligent design. My problem with intelligent design is I don't regard that as science either. Okay, but it is an argument, not necessarily a scientific argument. Okay, but what evolution really cannot do is explain how we developed complicated organs. Okay, in terms of such as an eye. Okay, because the idea is the answer. From advocates of evolution biologists, they'll tell you that, well, each of the individual stages, there was some use to it, even though you didn't have a finished eye. Okay, so, for instance, let's take, there's actually a very good article in a publication from the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. You take a poisonous snake, okay, what does that require? Okay, that this, and most snakes are not poisonous, okay, so the in terms of what great advantage in terms of that, there are plenty of snakes get by without having any poison. Okay, but that's number one. Number two, what's it take to create a poisonous snake? Well, you'd have to develop a toxin. At the same time, to protect the snake from itself, you'd have to develop an antitoxin with that. Okay, you have to develop a pump system. Okay, it's going to lead to specialized teeth, fangs, okay, that are hollow. Okay, and you can inject it. Plus, these fangs are going to be pretty delicate, so you have to have the ability to grow it. Okay, now all of this has to take place, you would think, at pretty much at the same time. Biologists will tell you, no, we don't understand what it is, but along the way, each of these things, as it was developed, had to have some benefit or use. Again, you have a problem in terms of certain animals, blind cavefish. Okay, have what appear to be perfectly good organs, eyes, and skin grew over the eyes. Okay, so I looked in, my son Gabi was in a bookstore about a month ago, 2 months ago, to exchange a book, and I was looking at Richard Dawkins' new book. Richard Dawkins is a British biologist who's a very big advocate of, in terms of, militant advocate in terms of evolution. And he was saying, well, you know, blind cavefish, when their skin grew over their eyes, they were probably, you know, maybe they were less prone to infection, therefore they had a higher survival rate. Okay, right. These are the things you get. So, again, there are no knockout punches on this, but real questions can be raised. And since we're running out of time, I just want to skip ahead. There's also, in terms of how Hirsch also does this with history. Okay, just very briefly, for instance, this is not an example that he used, but one of my favorites in terms of the great coincidences in history, so to speak. In the 1864 Wilderness Campaign, Grant made his biggest tactical blunder of the war, in which he divided his army, put it on two separate banks of the river. This is a crucial period in time because Lincoln was, they had polls, Lincoln was trailing very badly in the polls. Everyone was thinking that the war is not winnable, and Lee was in a position to deal Grant a knockout blow. Okay, what happened was that Robert E. Lee became bedridden, physically unable to function for 3 days, right at this moment, and Lee saw it immediately, his opportunity. He became sick, he could not function for 3 days. Okay, it was the only 3 days of the war that we know that he was incapacitated. Okay, so we're talking something like 3 out of 1,500 days. This is the time that it happens, and also any subordinate that he would have had, Jeb Stuart, James Longstreet, Stonewall Jackson, they'd all been killed or wounded recently, and no one else was there that he would trust to lead the army. Okay, these things, but the professor I heard give a lecture on this, Gary Gallagher from the University of Virginia, I mean, he just goes like, incredible coincidence. Okay, and this is basically the point. What Bob Hirsch then does is basically this stand whole time on his head. Okay, and just to give you that again, what Holtheim said, okay, was that a Jew has only one choice, either to remain in the four amos of rabbinic Judaism, stuck in the past, or to live in the modern world and cease to be orthodox. Okay, what Rav Hirsch does, and not just Rav Hirsch, but others, okay, is the idea is that, not so fast, okay, to not believe in a God, to not believe in the Torah, okay, you're faced with, in science, and in history, a series of incredible coincidences. So Rav Hirsch, I think, would stand that on his head, and with, he didn't say this, but something like this, a Jew has only one choice, either to make a leap of faith and believe the natural world and human history, the result of a series of incredible coincidences, or to see God as the creator and director and the Torah as his guide to man. Okay? In short, this approach, certainly in Germany, okay, by 1850 had stemmed the tide. Okay, so that in the first half, from 1800 to 1850, almost no Jew raised in an observant home remained observant. Okay, from 1850 on up through Hitler, okay, nutrition rate was almost nil. You could say a lot more. I don't think we're going to have time. I just want to conclude with something that's important. Also to point out that Rav Hirsch did not just see modernity as a challenge. Okay, he saw it as a tremendous opportunity. And again, I'm sorry, this quote is somewhat long, but that aspect, I think it's, you don't get a true appreciation of his thought if you just dwell on what he saw as the challenges of modernity, but also to know the opportunity. And just like to read this passage and conclude with this. He says, the more we understand that Judaism reckons with all of man's endeavors, and the more its declared mission includes the salvation of all mankind, the less its views be confined to the four cubits of one room or one dwelling. The more a Jew is a Jew, the more universalist will be his views and aspirations. The less alien will he be to anything that is noble and good, true and upright, in the arts and sciences, in civilization and culture. The more a Jew is a Jew, the more joyously will he hail everything that will shape human life so as to promote truth, right, peace, and refinement among mankind. The more happily will he himself embrace every opportunity to prove his mission as a Jew on new, still untrodden grounds. The more the Jew is a Jew, the more gladly will he give himself to all that is true progress in civilization and culture, provided that in this new circumstance he will not only maintain his Judaism, but will be able to bring it ever more to glorious fulfillment. Okay, that, however, is a topic for another time, and I thank you for your kind attention.